This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring 100% natural fiber clothing for women and men, real clothing for real people. Proud to sponsor the important voice of KABU, Gazelle is located at Northeast 41st and Fremont and can be reached at 503-288-3422. And now the Recovery Zone with host Stephanie Potter.
I'm Stephanie Potter, and welcome to the Recovery Zone here on KABU Radio. Just briefly, I'd like to mention that the Recovery Zone is about meeting with people and groups who are working to help us heal as a society. They're helping us to recover from a way of life based on economic and military domination and a way of life that is ultimately not sustainable. I'd like to start out today by sharing a quote I recently ran across by Mahatma Gandhi. God forbid that India should ever take to industrialism after the manner of the West. The economic imperialism of a single tiny island kingdom is today keeping the world in chains. If an entire nation of 300 million took to similar economic exploitation, it would strip the world bare like locusts. My guests today are attempting to reverse this process of stripping bare. They're working with a group called Village Focus International and have recently established offices here in Portland. VFI is a nonprofit, U.S.-based organization working to empower communities and leaders in Laos, Cambodia, and southern India. It was incorporated in 2000 by a group of Lao people and two Americans. One of those Americans is Todd Sigety, who's here in Portland and who I'm speaking with today. Besides being the co-founder of VFI, Todd is an environmental legal expert who has worked for the past 3 years on conservation and forest reform in both Laos and Cambodia. So, Todd, welcome, and I'm glad you're here.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
And we also have with us Jessica Work. She's only 23 years old, but has over 7 years of experience already working in rural communities, and, in fact, just recently was in Bolivia and apparently barely escaped with her life as guns were firing. So we're glad you're here, Jessica. Mm-hmm. And she's VFI's development director and has spent the first 3 months of this year visiting VFI projects in Laos, Cambodia, and India. So, Jessica, welcome.
Thank you.
Okay. I'd like to start out by asking, what's the mission of Village Focus mm-hmm. International?
Mm-hmm. The mission is to empower local leaders in developing countries, specifically Laos, Cambodia, and southern India, to design and implement projects that create change in their own communities, to reverse the institution of colonial development around the world instead of the outside experts deciding what the issues are for these countries, but to allow the people themselves to create change. And that's what it's all about.
Uh-huh. And so I was reading in the website, it's considered bottom up is how you're working?
Yes, exactly, bottom up. And as someone who's been on the top down side for certain projects in development over the years, you realize that true change really does happen bottom up in communities. And the idea is to allow the development world to understand this and work that way.
And maybe you could tell us how you see this bottom up working when you go to a specific project, Jessica?
Well, most of VFI's staff are local leaders. Now there are over 40 between Laos and Cambodia. And many of these staff members are village people who became involved with the work that was being done and actually asked if they could become staff. So community members are deciding what should happen on all levels, planning and implementation. And in terms of the expat involvement that we do, it's more of a support role of fundraising and outreach.
Yeah, an example is, say, birth spacing, issues of infant health care. And one solution that came out of it was local community indigenous people with our own staff deciding that what they should do, because they have their own cultural rules, is how to improve the health care process of giving birth. And what they did is build birthing houses, because you have to give birth directly onto the ground, and you can't give birth in your own home. Those are some of the rules locally that you have to work with. So they built a community birthing house designed by the community that could work around these parameters. It's obviously raised from the ground, but what they're doing is adding their own sand from each of the family's plots into the cement mix. and they feel that would work. It's an example of how a solution could come out of a long process of working together and trust with a community that never would have been designed from outside of the community.
Right. And these are the people that live there then mm-hmm. coming up with their own solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And when you guys go to these countries, what sorts of threats do you find the people facing?
There's two levels of big threats and fears. And the first one, for people who don't know, Laos and Cambodia were key parts of the Vietnam War. And as you mentioned, the theme of recovery for your show here, the United States spent over $34 billion on an 8-year bombing campaign in Laos along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. So basically, from the mid-60s until now, there has been a threat from the outside that has either been from external war and bombing. In many of the villages we work, they don't even understand why that occurred. You know, here you are every day, imagine poor, wake up, and for 8 years, bombs are going off all day.
It's horrifying.
What's the context of that?
Yeah.
So to be there now working as an American on recovery of this region, humanitarian purposes, is very empowering. The second thing, though, there are threats now coming from road development, from outside corporate development, from a lot of outside influences that coming to remote areas that never were there or able to get there in the past. Laos is an extremely isolated country, and now that isolation is getting smaller and smaller each day. So how do you empower communities to be able to handle what is coming and understand the context of it so they can actually have a say?
Right. And so some of the issues that you actually are working on with these people?
There's a few general areas. A big one is natural resource management. There's a new road being paved through southern Laos towards Vietnam, and illegal logging and traders are coming through for the first time. VFI has a lot of education programs to train people on how to properly manage the resources and also to work with them and the local government to get land titles so that they can defend their land when people come trying to exploit their natural resources. So that's really important for maintaining cultures and preserving people's lifestyles so that they are not forced to leave once all the trees are cut down. They can actually defend that before it happens.
In other words, keep their trees.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And then there's also, go along with that, is food security, you know, to ease annual food shortages that are common. Formal education, building schools, health education.
And also something to do with child empowerment and protection.
Yeah, especially in Cambodia, where there's a big problem with child trafficking and pedophilia, where foreign sex tourists come to exploit children. We have some projects working against that.
And so what are some of the things that you guys are working for to get support for right now, some real needs right now?
Well, there are three specific projects right now that we're looking for funding and to continue the work and start some of the work. It wouldn't happen unless we get some financial support. The first one is land rights protection for indigenous people, both in Laos and Cambodia. I was part of the legal reform, but people now have the collective ability for community title, which is, you know, their traditional lands of indigenous people throughout Laos and Cambodia, now formally recognized in law that it's theirs for title. However, they often don't know that this is actually the law now, and there is a huge increase in land speculation by corrupt officials, by outside influences from Chinese businesses to Vietnamese traders, and they are stealing these lands at an alarming rate. It's become a international crisis identified by the UN, actually. And I just got back from 4 years of working specifically on this. What we've been able to do is to have a network of indigenous leaders from throughout the countries that have been meeting for the last few years, learning their rights, writing down what they need, and going around, and every single community that has had the ability to have a network and awareness and activities has not sold their land. So you can have a great impact. We have been able to stop logging for the first time, Laos, in a community that was able to get their land and their community forest allocated.
That's true.
Against the Vietnamese logger. It's small, but it's a start. And in Cambodia, there was over 80 hectares returned to a community last year because we had people fly up from the capital, review it, and demand that the law be followed. So things can happen for a very small input, and we're trying to get financial support to be able to work with more villages and get the word out.
And you had another project, Jessica?
Yeah. In India, we're just starting up a partnership with a few amazing local NGOs who are really, really inspiring activists. They're strong followers of Gandhi. It's interesting that you read the Gandhi quote at the beginning of the show. But so empowering. And there's a couple of main project areas. One is fighting child labor, which really is a poverty issue when families are not making enough to eat. They send their children to work instead of school. So there's two different organizations that we work with that first they rescue children from these situations of labor, often first bonded labor in garment factories and in the lime industry, lime quarries. And then they attempt to reunite the children with the families, but provide education and alternate income-generating activities, such as organizing women into small business groups so they can start a tea shop or purchase an extra cow or something so that they can supplement the income that the child was bringing in. So this is, it's a very holistic way of approaching the situation and the problem from all different levels. They also teach yoga and meditation to the family, so it's very integrated. It's very, I think it could only happen in India on such an amazing level. But then also another amazing project there is with a local organization called Subiksha, and they, with no funding, they're just renegades on motorbikes, and they drive through the countryside, and they've organized over, I think, 35,000 women into self-help groups, just providing education and awareness of what you can accomplish when you have a strong community and you have a group of women that meets regularly, to learn about environmental issues, political issues, health, and then educate their communities. And these women rarely came out of their houses before. And when they started organizing, honestly, some of the women, they would have a little political training and say, so do you know the name of the country we live in? And they didn't know. And they would say the name of the village, or they would forget the name of the village even. And now these women are being elected as presidents of their villages. It's happened in about 45 villages.
I'm getting a chill.
It's amazing. And they are completely broke. They do this with no money. And money, they look at me and they say, Miss Jessica, do not think about money now. We want to show you the power of the truth of Gandhi. Money is one of our tools. But that said, I saw a lot of, you know, gaps where they could even step it up just explosively if they had a little bit of support. So we're looking for that support for that.
Great.
It's true, though. If I took you to Laos today, if you walked into a village that our staff had not worked, the man would walk out as the chief, and he would shake your hand, and you wouldn't meet anybody, any men or any children or women. If you went back 3 or 4 years later, after the whole crew had been through there working every day, all of the kids and the women would run out, and half of the women would be part of the planning team. That's how you get to education and healthcare and agricultural issues, is you go through that. You don't go through the chief or the men. The men don't do half of the work. Same here, maybe. Right? A final project I wanted to mention is a child protection empowerment project in Cambodia. Cambodia, since 1999, has seen an incredible influx of tourism from Angkor Wat to other places. It's also seen a huge influx of pedophilia and sex trade. It's become a hotspot zone for sex offenders around the world. There are coded websites that can tell you exactly where to go, what beach, what shop. And one of these areas is called Sihanoukville. It's on the ocean. And about 4 years ago, some members of the community wanted to get together to protect and save their own community from going this direction. And we have been working with local organizations there to set up a child protection center. Now it's over 300 kids in a network. They wear T-shirts. They go around and do plays. They've written a book. And they are reclaiming the streets, the beaches, the kids. And they have also, similar to India, it's very holistic. They have a mother's group that is working to set up co-ops, economic opportunities. There's also a group now set up that investigates and has caused over 6 people to be arrested last year that would have never happened before. And so we're constantly looking for support for this.
Terrific. Just to take a moment here, I'm going to let the listening audience know that you're listening to The Recovery Zone on KBOO Radio. And I'm speaking here with Jessica Work and Todd Sigety, who are with Village Focus International. And if you'd like to find out more about what their group is doing, you can also go to their website at villagefocus.org, www.villagefocus.org. And you were started in 2000, and I'd like you to explain a little bit about how that came about, how you actually got going.
Yeah, it was a convergence on a road that had to happen. Both the two Americans that you mentioned, myself and Rick Reese, after going through an education process and then both of us working internationally from everything from Peace Corps to the World Bank, you realize what works and doesn't work. And we were pretty frustrated. We were frustrated with the top-down, what Jess actually calls MIC development, which I kind of like. There's a lot of nonprofit organizations that are quite large that pretty much franchise themselves. And they don't visit the field. They demand money be sent back home, and their overheads are not what they say they are.
So these are the nonprofit.
These are nonprofits from the United States.
What we call NGOs.
501c3 NGOs.
Wow.
Right.
Okay.
That still operate this way. And What is being left behind? I can be a so-called expert in legal advice and be working and getting paid, and if you keep going back to the same country, you realize what is being left behind. Who are the local experts? Why are we being called in to answer questions and work on legislation, work in the field on agricultural projects? Where are the local people doing this? And especially Laos and Cambodia, there's a real need to develop these skills. And so we wanted to create a paradigm that would allow this to happen in the work. And it usually takes a lot of time. And in Laos, we found a marriage with a couple of local people, two women specifically, who will be coming to Portland, the first trip to the United States in August. And Nong and Yai is their name. Nong is a Lao doctor. In 1975, after the war, there were only five doctors left in the whole country. To have a doctor wanting to work in the rural countryside, to work to empower villages instead of, you know, going for the big bucks living in the capital. And she wanted to create autonomy to be able to do the work she believed in. And she is really the heart and spirit of what we had hoped to accomplish. She was actually a finalist for the Nobel Peace Prize last year.
Wow.
So within just that short period of time, that's building capacity of staff and local leaders.
And so here you are. And what you're doing now is a bridge with the U.S. to these countries over in Asia. And would you like to say a little more then, Jessica?
Yeah, I was in Laos for the month of March, and really about every 10 meters in the villages where we work, you see craters, just pockmarks in the earth where bombs hit, and you know, people have no idea. And that's a reminder every moment of what's happened there and what our government has done. And so I think it's really interesting to be in Portland with this strong activism, and people are very interested in local issues. And really what we do in Laos and Cambodia is work locally, and being a bridge really important to me, because I see we have all these resources in Portland, and really I think that we sort of have a responsibility to invest in places that our government has devastated, because our government isn't doing the reconciliation. It's up to us.
As individuals here.
As individuals with the political consciousness and awareness of the wrong that has been done. And we can do a lot to make it right. Really small investments do a lot. It's almost a non-monetary economy there. There's a lot of just people forage in the forest for a lot of their food still. And they don't have markets in town, really. There's no money being exchanged. So when you go as a foreign organization with a limited amount of resources, you can do a lot, such as building a school for only a few $1,000 there that you can staff and make curriculum and get materials for a year.
Yeah, I mean, I've worked on, you know, $40 million World Bank projects, and that's not good development. The answer is not more money. I mean, the answer is the efficient use and having, you know, the local process occur. And most development work doesn't have the patience. If you rely on governments, if you rely on institutions that are large, they don't have the patience, nor do they have the skill, really, to work at the local level. Mm-hmm. And real change is happening at the local level.
And one of the things that we hear, we're bringing the fair market, we're going to bring free trade. And is this what these people want?
Do they want
the American way of life?
You know what they want is they want to be able to feed their kids, they want to be able to have an opportunity, and they want to be able to survive, and they want to be able to live on their own land. I mean, like Jess said, where we work, people look at their forest park, okay, their Mount Tabor. That's their grocery store, that's their healthcare center, pharmacy, that's their hardware store. You know, it's everything to them. And what happened is that is being taken. That's being threatened.
And what about democracy?
If part of democracy is actually the community process of making a decision, which that actually is what people want. And that is something that is universal. I think a lot of people either have the fear that that can't happen, or they haven't had experience of that happening. And that is one thing that is good to share with the world in their own cultural context.
And what would you say, then, that these people could teach Americans?
Well, one thing that I have learned that's been tremendously important in my own life is just simplicity. And, I mean, families are so close and communities are so tightly knit in these places where, you know, that's what people have. That is their resources, their community. And that's something that we overlook here because we can buy things that we think will replace community. But it's not true, and that's something that I've learned firsthand by talking to villagers.
And, you know, we're very individualist in America. We're rewarded for being individually powerful, even though we want community, especially in Portland. And I think one thing I've learned from working in these communities is that their comparative advantage in the world is not coffee. It's not computers. Their comparative advantage is their community and that knowledge of survival together. And that's a wonderful thing to take home and work in our own community. We really need each other to make it happen.
And I don't know, just appreciation of nature also. I was visiting indigenous communities in India, Cambodia, and Laos for the last few months, and everywhere I went, people said, this is our land, and we're going to fight for it until the day we die, and they're never going to take it away from us. And it's so vitally important. And I don't know, I grew up in Chicago, and I never, you know, went camping or anything when I was a kid, and so I never really understood, like, forests are vital for people, you know, but that's really true. That's something that I've learned.
And I learned more sitting for a few weeks with indigenous people in Laos and Cambodia than I ever did in my years of school and experience about forest management. And basically, you know, within every indigenous community that I've worked in over there, there's a division of, it's a communal forest, but each family has trees they own. Each family has a plot of burial forest. I mean, this is similar to any animist society, probably Native Americans going back. It's a common system throughout the world.
So they sort of even consider these trees part of their own family?
They are part of their family. They basically have passed through generations. They are the stewards for these specific trees, actually, and specific areas of the forest.
And also, I moved to the Northwest not too long ago, and there's definitely, you know, people have some pretty powerful relationships with the forest here, too. But I feel like in our society, it's something we're trying to recultivate and reestablish that we've lost in previous generations. And that also is why it's so important to bridge this connection with indigenous communities like in Laos, where they haven't lost that knowledge, that innate, intimate knowledge of the forest. And that has to be preserved.
Right, just a real connection with trees, with land.
Yeah.
They know that their survival is based on that respect and connection. And, you know, do we have that innate feeling that our survival depends on it?
It doesn't seem like it. It's a little scary right now.
One other good story. When I was in one village in Laos, people, they have a very close relationship with the... It's called Pi, which means ghosts or spirits, and those are ancestor and forest spirits. And people listen, they hear it, and they describe it as they audibly hear it. And they were like, can't you hear the ghosts in the forest? And I was like, no, not really. I can't actually hear the ghosts. And they're like, well, why? And I was just like, you guys speak the same language.
Yeah, basically they're connected to stuff that we don't even understand.
Just a different level
right.
of awareness.
Yeah. Right. And in the post 9/11 era, maybe there's things we can be learning from them about the language of forgiveness.
Yeah, it's also to stand across the table from a communist official in Laos or Vietnam or Cambodia who probably fought against relatives of mine, and they can sit there and drink a beer with you and say, let's move forward. That's a lot we can learn from when we can't even do that at home. We can't even do that in our own communities, is to work through those things. And just to understand who we are as Americans, not only who we think we are, but how other people see us. And what we represent, both as the negative side, but also the positive. People do look at America as an opportunity for positive change. And to be able to help provide an opportunity is something that we can at home understand. And we don't have to do it by flying to Laos or flying to Cambodia. You can reach out in your own community. Half of the Thai restaurants in Portland, are, if you go back in the kitchen, they're all Lao people. I mean, if you go out, there's a Hmong church and there's a Lao temple. There is, you know, everything. Go to Hispanic theater. Go meet Cambodian people during their New Year's in April. I mean, do things in Portland. Talk to groups like us. How to get involved. How to meet people. How to learn. Get on the websites. You can be an incredible activist at home here in Portland.
And if people are interested in getting more involved with Village Focus International, what do you suggest?
Well, just raising awareness of these issues is really important to all of us personally, because when I visit villages, they explicitly tell me, we want you to take our story back to your country. You're from a rich, powerful country. We want your people to know about us. And so just sharing that information, I feel like I'm sort of completing the mission that they've sent me home with. But definitely other types of support are wonderful. And, you know, we want to start having more events because we've only had a Portland office for a few months, really. But just fundraising, of course, is part of it, but really just spreading the word that we're out here.
Mm-hmm. We had a group of people from Portland and people in Cambodia and Laos film a video to tell a lot of the stories. And we'll be screening and showing that video later this summer, which will be on our website. We're also, as I mentioned, Nong and Yai, the co-founders from Laos. She's a Nobel Peace Prize finalist and really in charge of everything. She'll be coming in late August. We'll have a nice event for her. So we'll be doing things locally. Also, we'll be just garnering support. Like Jess mentioned, starting some new partnerships in southern India, where you know over 8,000 children have been rescued from factory work and labor by a small part organization called SAVE. And you know that is just the smallest of capital investment is really making an impact. So obviously financial support for some projects. We have a bylaw and a rule that every single project, over 90% of the funds go directly to the local activity and the staff.
And the staff completely, except for a handful, is the people that live
right,
there.
Right, everybody in India are all Indians. Over 30 people in Laos are all Lao, and actually not only that, but more than half of them are ethnic minorities. In Cambodia, there's over 10 Cambodians.
So hopefully your program just really keeps flourishing, and like you're going to go to the Philippines next. And
Step by step.
Yeah,
it's a good Lao saying,
step.
A step by step.
Step by step. And then your website.
Villagefocus.org.
Villagefocus.org.
One word, villagefocus.org.
Okay. Yeah. And you have a phone number?
Phone number is 503-788-7666.
Okay, well, and I've been speaking with Todd Sigety and Jessica Work, and both of them are very much involved with Village Focus International, which is a group that has just come to Portland. Well, I want to again just thank both of you guys for coming. This has been The Recovery Zone on KBOO Radio. I'm Stephanie Potter, and thanks for coming, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This just in, former Enron chiefs Kenneth Kennyboy Lay and Jeffrey Skilling were convicted today of conspiracy to commit securities and wire fraud. The verdict put the blame for the demise of what was once the nation's seventh largest company squarely on its top two executives. It came in the sixth day of deliberations following a trial that lasted nearly 4 months. Lay was also convicted of bank fraud and making false statements to banks in a separate trial related to his personal banking. Lay was convicted on all six counts against him in the trial with Skilling. Skilling was convicted on 19 of the 28 counts against and acquitted on the remaining nine. The former corporate titans are now convicted felons facing years in prison. Jurors declared through their verdict that both men repeatedly lied to cover a vast web of unsustainable accounting tricks and failing ventures that shoved Enron into bankruptcy protection in December 2001. And I am taking bets on a pardon. Let's see, folks, coming up next. Press Watch will not be on today here on the Thursday Morning Radio Zine for Thursday, May 25th. Instead, we'll hear